This is the Africa service of Vatican Radio.
Welcome to our half-hour daily program for Africa.
In today's program, you can hear our feature, Culture and Society and News for Young People. First, however, our bulletin of church news, followed by Africa News Panorama. I am Festus Tarawali. Pope Francis injured his right forearm after a fall on Thursday morning in his Casa Santa Marta residence in the Vatican, but did not suffer any fractures, the Holy See Press Office said in a statement. The arm was immobilized as a precautionary measure, read the statement. Despite the incident, the Pope continued with his scheduled audiences on Thursday morning, including a meeting with Mrs. Nesifo Nauska Jean-Jezil, chair of the Committee on World Food Security, and Mr. Alvaro Lario, president of the International Fund for Agricultural Development. Shortly after, the Pope met with His Grace Haji Dede Edmond Brahimaj, leader of the Bektashi community, an Islamic Sufi order in Tirana, Albania. Lisa Zengarini reports.
Welcoming the delegation led by His Grace D.D. Edmond Brahimaj, Pope Francis described the fraternal relations between the Catholic Church and the Bektashi community as a blessing for both, and expressed trust that they will grow stronger, serving fraternity and peaceful coexistence among peoples. Whenever religious leaders gather in a spirit of mutual respect and commit themselves to fostering a culture of encounter through dialogue, mutual understanding and cooperation, the hope for a better and more just world is renewed and confirmed, he said. The Pope remarked that in a world marred by the logic of violence and discord, religious convictions can help us to instead embrace more clearly the fundamental values of encounter, friendship and collaboration in the pursuit of the common good. Pope Francis recalled with gratitude the several occasions of fraternal encounter between the Bektashi community and the Catholic Church, including the prayer for peace in the Balkans in 1993 during the war in former Yugoslavia and the 2011 World Day of Prayer for Peace in Assisi. He remarked that their community, along with other Muslims, Christians and other believers in Albania, can serve as a bridge of reconciliation and mutual enrichment, not only in their country, but also between the East and the West. Concluding, Pope Francis reaffirmed that despite the present challenges, interreligious dialogue has a unique role in building a future of reconciliation, justice and peace that the peoples of the world and especially young people so ardently desire. I am Lisa Zingarini.
The Pope's last appointment on Thursday morning was his meeting with the members of the Argentine Priestly College of Rome. Pope Francis later sent out a post on the social media platform X, urging the faithful to listen to the needy. Writing through his @pontifex handle, the Pope said Jesus invites us not to be drawn in by worldly logic. We must rather listen to the least and the poor because God loves to speak to us through them, he said. In Kenya, Pope Francis appointed Father Jackson Murangara, until now parish priest and rector of the Consolata Shrine in the Archdiocese of Nairobi, as co-adjutor bishop of Meru Diocese, in the eastern part of the country. The coadjutor bishop-elect is a member of the Consolata Missionaries. He was born on the 7th of April 1970 in Kamanyaki, county of Tharaka Nithi in the Diocese of Meru. After entering the Institute of the Consolata Missionaries, he completed his studies in philosophy at the Consolata Institute of Philosophy in Nairobi and in theology at the Missionary Institute of London. He made his religious vows on the 18th of November 2000 and was ordained a priest on the 15th of August 2001 in his home diocese of Meru. After his ordination, he collaborated in the parishes of Kagene and Mujwa in the same diocese. In 2002, he was named parish vicar of Chiga in the Archdiocese of Kisumu. The following year, he was appointed as formator of postulants at the Consolata Seminary of Nairobi, a position he held until 2009. In 2011, Coadjutor Bishop-elect Jackson Murangara was awarded a licentiate in spiritual theology from the Pontifical Institute of Spirituality, also known as Theresianum in Rome. He then went on to serve as director of the Bethany House and Charity Home Pastoral Centers in the Diocese of Muranga. Since 2018, he has been serving as parish priest and rector of the Consolata Shrine in Nairobi. According to the Code of Canon Law, unlike an auxiliary bishop, a coadjutor bishop has the right of succession. In other news, Nathan Morley has this report on the ceasefire agreement reached between Hamas and Israel on Wednesday.
In both Israel and Gaza, there was some celebration at the news. The agreement was reached after intense negotiations in Doha. Israel and Hamas agreed to a Gaza ceasefire for hostages deal after intensive mediation by Qatar, Egypt and the United States. The implementation of the agreement, if it happens, will begin this coming Sunday, the 19th of January. According to the agreement, Hamas will release 33 hostages in the first phase, spanning 6 weeks, in an exchange for the release of Palestinian prisoners. The U.S. President is Joe Biden.
This deal was developed and negotiated under my administration, but its terms will be implemented, for the most part, by the next administration. In these past few days, we've been speaking as one team. This has been a time of real turmoil in the Middle East. But as I prepare to leave office, our friends are strong, our enemies are weak, and there's a genuine opportunities for a new future.
However, on Thursday, Israel accused Hamas of backtracking on the agreement, with a planned cabinet vote on the deal delayed. Earlier, the UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres welcomed the agreement, but stressed that it must ensure unhindered access to emergency aid in Gaza. UNICEF called the agreement timely and highlighted the enormous humanitarian crisis among the children of Gaza. At the same time, the head of the UN's UNRWA, Philippe Lazzarani, called for the rapid and unhindered access to emergency aid in Gaza. The International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC, emphasized its willingness to contribute. Meanwhile, at least 32 Palestinians were killed in Gaza since the ceasefire was announced on Wednesday evening. That's according to rescue workers. The Gaza Civil Defense said an apartment building with several homes was bombed. This all started when Hamas attacked southern Israel on the 7th of October 2023, killing around 1,200 people and taking 250 hostages. The attack triggered a massive Israeli offensive on Gaza, during which more than 46,000 Palestinians have been killed, according to the Hamas-run health ministry.
Nathan Morley reporting. You're tuned to the Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
News Panorama.
Tanzania has dismissed a World Health Organization WHO report of a suspected new outbreak of the Ebola-like Marburg virus in the northwest of the country. On Tuesday, the Global Health Agency said a total of 9 suspected cases were reported over the last 5 days in the Kagera region, including 8 deaths. The World Health Organization cautioned that the risk of the suspected virus spreading in the region remained high because Kagera was a transit hub with much cross-border movement to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Uganda, Burundi and Rwanda. But in a statement, Tanzania's Health Minister Jenista Mahanga said, after samples were analyzed, all suspected cases were found negative for Marburg virus. Tanzania experienced its first Marburg outbreak in March 2023 in the Bukoba district. It killed 6 people and lasted for nearly 2 months. The highly infectious disease is similar to Ebola, with symptoms including fever, muscle pain, diarrhea, vomiting, and in some cases death through extreme blood loss. South African rescuers ended their attempts on Thursday to find anyone left in an illegal gold mine where at least 78 people died during a police siege. Police had encircled the mine since August and cut off food and water supplies to try to force the miners out so they could be arrested. This move resulted in what the Giwusu Labor Union called the worst state-sponsored massacre since the end of apartheid. Since Monday, rescuers have used a cylindrical metal cage to pull up 78 bodies and 246 survivors, some of them emaciated and disoriented. The action followed a court order to carry out the operation at the mine near the town of Stilfontein, southwest of Johannesburg. The survivors, who are mostly from Mozambique, Zimbabwe and Lesotho, have been arrested and charged with illegal immigration, trespass, illegal mining and other offences. Meantime, a Congolese court in Bukavu, the capital of Eastern South Kivu province, has sentenced three Chinese citizens to 7 years in prison after they were arrested in possession of gold bars and $400,000 in cash. They were found guilty of illegal activities linked to the artisanal mining sector. The trio are the first Chinese nationals to stand trial since Democratic Republic of Congo launched its latest push to crack down on the unlicensed extraction of the many precious and strategic minerals buried in its conflict-torn east. Mozambique's new president, Daniel Chapo, has been sworn in at a low-key ceremony in the capital, Maputo, that was marred by an opposition boycott following heavily disputed elections. In his first presidential address, 47-year-old Chapo pledged to devote all his energies to promoting unity and human rights in a nation scarred by post-election violence. You are tuned to the Daily Africa Service of Vatican Radio. This is Culture and Society, and you are welcome to the program. My name is Kanyanta Godfrey Kampamba. Elections are pivotal milestones in post-conflict countries, and nowhere is vote anticipation felt more keenly than in South Sudan, the world's youngest nation. But since its independence in 2011, South Sudan has never had an election. The ones that were meant to be held in December of 2024 were postponed in September after growing warnings that the country was not adequately prepared. This perpetuated a seemingly endless cycle of election postponements, and analysts say that the resulting defer of democracy has eroded the trust of citizens in the post-independence government of South Sudan and damaged its credibility in the eyes of regional and international decision makers. But we heard in our last program that despite the setback of a further 2-year delay in holding elections, there is still hope that South Sudan can build capacity and become the democratic, stable society that its people deserve. This is also the optimistic view of the United Nations Special Representative and Head of the United Nations Mission in South Sudan, UNMISS, Nicholas Haysom, who has recently told the media that he is confident that South Sudan can make a lot of progress in spite of a number of major challenges, including climate shocks and war over the border in Sudan. Haysom is a South African-born veteran and special representative who once served as chief legal advisor to Nelson Mandela. Speaking from that added experience, Haysom told Ben Malo that the situation in South Sudan can change for the better as long as there is political will on the part of the country's leaders.
Lorna Merikaji also gave a very dire indictment of the situation in South Sudan. And I quote her in her briefing to the Security Council. She said, South Sudan is a sad story and on the brink of collapse.
No, I don't think it's on the brink of collapse. It's a sad story, but is it capable of addressing either the delay, the backlog, the aspirations of its people? Yes, they are capable. And we think with the additional time before elections, there is in fact a silver lining. What is that silver lining? It's because we're not there to run elections. We're there to build a democratic, stable society. Elections is one of the ways in which we do that. And the elections gives us an opportunity to engage in capacity building, allow South Sudanese to develop platforms for building their own democracy. Remember, this is not a UN project. This is a South Sudanese project. It's building on a peace agreement between South Sudanese and on the issues that they themselves agreed to in their peace negotiations. So we are confident that they can get there. Of course, people will say one of the preconditions is political will on the part of the leaders. And to be sure, there's an element there that absolutely correct. We need to build political will. All the parties themselves need to develop that political will. I would not go so far as to say that this is a task which South Sudanese cannot accomplish.
You stay hopeful. If we could move to the humanitarian side of things, The vast majority of South Sudanese, over 75%, are facing acute food insecurity, according to the latest reports. We have floods, then we have conflict, and then we have certain situations of disease. How is the UN assisting the people of South Sudan in all these crises?
Well, we are assisting them in all these crises by assisting them in all these crises. We are engaged supplying anti-cholera kits around the country to deal with the cholera outbreak, most of it coming from the north, from the conflict in Sudan. We have quite successfully, quite frankly, managed to contain the potential disastrous consequences of the floods, which is not to say we're out of the woods, but to say that the initial estimates of 3.3 million people being affected has now been downgraded to 1.5. And that's partly because of really effective relationship with host governments at local level and at national level in warning communities to seek higher ground in time. Of course, what you didn't mention is that we also have probably by the end of the year upwards of 1 million of refugees from Sudan coming through, spilling over from that conflict. And when you take all that together, and of course the collapse in the pipeline that supplied over 70% of the fuel, you've got all the elements necessary for a perfect storm. And so the question is that we've had to be on our toes, and I think in regard to each of those issues, we are engaged, but we're engaged with South Sudanese. Are the elements at this critical point there for a disastrous perfect storm? Yes, they are. But we're aware of it. We have task forces from Renk to Malakal working on each area's specific issues. And I think we're doing a great job, as are the South Sudanese. And let me just take my hat off to the South Sudanese. It's the South Sudanese who've largely absorbed the million or so refugees and IDPs that have come through from Sudan. They've done so, although they themselves have not, those of them who were civil servants, have not been paid their salaries for 9 to 10 months, in which the country was already undergoing the privations of an extended food insecurity moment. But they've been prepared to continue absorbing Sudanese and ex-South Sudanese IDPs as they come through.
You have mentioned the conflict in Khartoum in Sudan, up north of South Sudan. What is the overall impact of this conflict on you and the team and your work in South Sudan?
Well, the first and most obvious impact, of course, is the spillover of refugees from the conflict in Sudan. The current number is approximately between 500 and 700 a day, and we've been able to absorb them in the along the Nile corridor from Malakal to Renk by largely integrating them into communities. But if, for example, a more significant town or urban development like Kosti were to be overrun, then the 500 or 700 could become 5,000 or 7,000. That would overwhelm us, and we would not be able, I think, to avert a catastrophe that would present. Prices have rocketed. Inflation has affected the country quite significantly. We've, you know, got the outbreak of diseases, which you mentioned, and almost in biblical, in a sort of biblical comparison, we now have a plague of a particular kind of bird that is eating the sorghum maize. So there's almost no potential catastrophe which the South Sudanese are not facing. And so we need to also respect their resilience to really quite a significant set of challenges.
United Nations Special Representative and Head of the United Nations Mission in South Sudan, UNMISS, Nicholas Haysom, speaking there with Ben Malo, explaining the fact that the situation in South Sudan can change for the better as long as the political will is there on the part of the country's leaders. And that is all we have time for in this edition of Culture and Society. Until next week, at the same time, my name is Kanyanta Godfrey Kampamba.
We shall overcome, the Lord one day. We do believe, Lord, we shall overcome, Lord one day.
And now, news for young people.
Hello and welcome to the program. I am Festus Tarawali. Pope Francis on Wednesday urged all Catholics and people of goodwill to do their part in protecting and promoting the welfare of children. Continuing his catechesis on children at the midweek general audience, the Pope said Jesus wants us to be free and happy, so he asks us to stop and listen to the suffering of the voiceless. Fighting exploitation, especially child exploitation, is the path to build a better future for the whole society, the Pope said. In last week's general audience, the Pope denounced the scourge of child labor and other abuses suffered by children, saying anyone who harms or exploits a child will have to answer to God. He also reminded the faithful that they cannot remain indifferent to the problem of child labor. Speaking about child welfare at this week's general audience, the Pope said today many children living in poverty are forced to work while other children suffer from abuse and maltreatment or have recourse to drugs or gangs. In his reflection in Italian, the Pope praised those countries that have had the wisdom to put children's rights in writing. He went on to suggest ways we can help eradicate child labor and not be complicit in it. First of all, said the Pope, we must recognize that if we want to eradicate child labor, we cannot be complicit in it. And when is this the case, he asked. For example, when we purchase products that involve child labor, how can we eat and dress knowing that behind that food and those garments are exploited children who work instead of going to school? Find out where those products come from. Awareness of what we purchase is a first act in order not to be complicit, the Pope said. Continuing, the Holy Father said institutions, including church institutions and companies, must also be reminded of their responsibility. They can make a difference by shifting their investments to companies that do not use or permit child labor. He urged the many states and international organizations that have already enacted laws and directives against child labor to do more to end the practice. The Pope also appealed to journalists to do their part, saying they can help raise awareness of the problem and help find solutions. Do not be afraid. Denounce these things, the Pope urged. Earlier this week, a meeting of a panel of child rights experts opened at the UN in Geneva against the backdrop of conflict and economic challenges. UN News' Daniel Johnson has more on that story.
The Committee on the Rights of the Child reconvened in Geneva on Monday, where it heard that youngsters the world over continue to be profoundly impacted by economic downturns, climate change, public health emergencies, and armed conflict. The committee's independent rights experts are mandated by the UN General Assembly to review countries' progress in promoting and protecting children's rights in line with the Convention on the Rights of the Child. They are not UN staff, nor are they paid for their work. Andrea Ori, representative of the UN Secretary General, noted that one in six children live in regions plagued by violent conflict. Every day, he said, they are victims of killing, maiming, recruitment into the armed forces, attacks on schools or hospitals, rape or sexual violence, abduction and denial of humanitarian access. Faced with these challenges, Mr. Urig urged all governments to honour their commitments under the convention and protect young people, in particular by ensuring that those who harm them face accountability.
Children have voiced their opinion about what access to justice and effective remedy means for them, highlighting the importance of being safe, feeling respected and fairly treated regardless of who they are, and receiving proper support. Many children said that they feel a sense of satisfaction when serious action is taken in response to violation of their rights, when this wrongful act is now not repeated, and when the person violating children's rights learns from their mistakes.
Committee Chair Anne-Marie Skelton insisted that children's rights continue to be violated across the world, particularly in conflict zones. In Sudan and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, wartime sexual violence against children has been widespread, she noted. In Gaza, meanwhile, children constitute a significant portion of the casualties, and grave violations against children continue to be witnessed daily, said Ms. Skelton. The committee is in session until the end of January. Under review are Ecuador, Eritrea, the Gambia, Honduras, Peru, St. Kitts and Nevis, and Slovakia.
And that's all for this edition of News for Young People. Till the same time next week, I am Festus Tarawali. You're tuned to the Africa Service of Vatican Radio. In our next program at the same time tomorrow, you can hear our feature, Development and the Economy, and a reflection by Father Enobong Udiadiong. Praised be Jesus Christ. Laudetur Jesus Christus.